This is Backstory, the show that turns to the past to understand the world around us today. I'm Peter Onuf, historian of 18th century America.
I'm Ed Ayers, historian of 19th century America.
And I'm Brian Bellow, historian of the 20th century. Today on the show, we're taking on the history of climate change, but not the kind of global climate change that we're used to hearing about today. We're talking about how people have gone about changing their own immediate climates, be it heating, air conditioning, or as we just heard a minute ago, sending huge blocks of ice thousands of miles.
We're going to go back to the phones now. Next up on the line, we have Travis calling from Fountain Valley, California. Travis, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
We're talking about climate control. Crank up our thermostat.
Well, you guys should probably know then what I do for a living is that I am a mechanical engineer who designs air conditioning systems.
All right. Yes. We have been waiting for you.
Travis, do you make house calls? Because it's incredibly hot here in the studio.
Well, what I like to tell my wife is that I can't actually turn any nuts and bolts, but I can draw you a really lovely picture of what it might be required.
We have a lot in common with historians. We don't actually make things happen, but we can talk about it, right?
Yeah. Well, give us a picture of what's on your mind.
Well, I had a story that a client of mine told me years ago, and I thought maybe you guys could confirm or deny or flush out the story a little bit for me.
Sure.
What he was talking about was, he called them the alphabet buildings, and this is a client of mine, so he was an architect, and he said that if you were to fly over a major metropolitan area in the U.S., and in some year prior to, and I don't know what year that is, that what you would see from above is a whole bunch of buildings shaped like L's and U's and O's and H's and T's that he would call the alphabet buildings. Mm-hmm. And the rationale there was that prior to commercial air conditioning, most buildings could only be 40 to 50 foot wide so that everyone could be within 25 foot of an operable window, that they'd have access to some outside air and not get stuffy and not get overly hot.
So you're questioning the validity of that?
So I'm questioning the validity of the story. And then I'm also wondering what that year is.
Okay. The year for the very first of the air-conditioned buildings to take what was going to come, I can't give you a specific year. I think the Metropolitan Museum in New York was 1905, 1906, that it was air-conditioned. The very wealthy in New York begin to get air conditioning in the first decade, second decade of the 20th century. The skyscraper, sooner rather than later, so we're talking about the 20s and the 30s, becomes air-conditioned. What that had to do with the shape of the building, Travis, I'm going to ask Ed that.
Because these buildings were generally built in the 19th century, the second half of the 19th century. And if you think of the classic example of a building of the sort you're talking about, it's the tenement. And the shape of those was dumbbell.
Yeah.
Okay? And it was exactly for what your friend said, which was a way to have a shaft, a space in the middle of the building that you could put as many people as possible in there. What you're looking for are as many exposed surfaces as possible so there can be as many windows as possible so you can put as many families as possible per square foot. Right. And until you have air conditioning, that's all you can do. And so I think that's why these buildings fit in that niche between large-scale urban housing for largely immigrant families, but before you start having the possibility of air conditioning those spaces. So I'm guessing it's the period between 1870, 1930 it would be the window, I would think.
Yeah. And Travis, what kind of systems do you work on? Personal ones, individual ones, large systems?
Oh, we're generally in the larger commercial range. And the reason that the idea is so interesting to me is that I rarely work on a building whose floor plate is less than, say, 60 foot on one side and 70, 80 foot on the other side. And so the idea that at some point that was just not possible until the advent of large-scale commercialization and availability of commercial air conditioning is just interesting to me.
Yeah. Thanks for calling.
Thank you, Travis.
Okay. Appreciate it, guys.
Mm-hmm.
So, Brian, you mentioned skyscrapers and department stores as a couple of the first places where people would have experienced air conditioning back in the first few decades of the 20th century. But that's not where air conditioning really started, was it?
That's right, Ed. The first time that air conditioning was actually used was in factories. And it was used for lots of different products that could not be mass manufactured if the temperature of those products continued to change. So in the case of magazines, for instance, the ink wouldn't run as the print runs continued. And they used it for textiles so that the actual thread itself wouldn't contract or expand depending on the amount of humidity in the air.
So what you're saying is that most people would have experienced air conditioning in the factories where they work?
Well, it wasn't really intended for the workers' comfort. When you put it that way, it sounds, we think, today, you know, oh yeah, right, workers need to be comfortable. Except this had nothing to do with the comfort of the workers working in those factories. It was all about consistency in a society that was incredibly driven by mass production.
Well, I'd like to think that some of those workers were a little bit more comfortable anyway, even
yeah.
if that wasn't the purpose, right?
Yeah. And when it comes to actually experiencing directly what we associate air conditioning with, cooling, probably most people would have had the kind of experience that Sidney Katz had. Now, loyal listeners to Backstory will remember Sidney as the grandfather of our senior producer, Tony Field. Sidney was born in New York City back in 1917, and a few days ago, I asked him where he first experienced air conditioning.
The first one was in a movie theater, like the Paramount Theater on Broadway. And you came in there, you came into another world.
Yeah.
It was cool and dry.
So did it make you feel, I mean, we talk about the movies as being a great escape in the 30s. Did that cool air add to that sense of unreality and escape for that hour and a half?
I guess it did, yes.
Movie theaters were very early adopters. There was a sense that the movie theater was to give you a sense of luxury, and the perfect climate was part of that.
That's Gail Cooper, a historian at Lehigh University, who's perhaps the foremost academic authority on the history of air conditioning. She told me that in those heady early days of artificial cooling, it wasn't about replacing the experience of being outdoors. It was about perfecting it. The engineers who designed those newfangled theater systems actually referred to them as man-made weather.
Not only did they control temperature and humidity, but they began to try to reproduce those other nice things about the natural climate. And some of the early systems came with perfume systems.
Really? I've always wondered about perfume. So when was this that there was perfume systems?
As early as 1917.
Wow.
Some of them came with different kind of lamps to mimic the natural wavelength of light outside. They came with fans that reproduced natural breezes.
Uh-huh.
And if you looked up at the ceiling, they would have little lights that mimic stars. And in that sense, air conditioning was just part of that, moving the best of nature indoors.
Now, you've got to keep in mind, this man-made weather stuff Gail Cooper's describing, well, it applies to the high end of movie houses. But back in Brooklyn, where Sidney Katz grew up, things were a little more, let's just say, primitive. And he should know. When he was a teenager in the 1930s, he worked as an usher in three different neighborhood theaters. The first one was cooled with fans, big, noisy, mechanical fans.
Theaters were built in the days of the silent movie. So any aberrant noise was really of no significance.
That was the first theater he worked in. The second one had something a little closer to that whole man-made weather thing Gail Cooper was talking about, just without the man-made part.
They had a roof that could be opened up.
You're kidding.
No, I'm kidding.
Kind of like that new stadium in Dallas.
I was an usher there. And as soon as it got dark, I'd go up there and sort of, like I could push it. They probably had a lot of good ball bearings on it, so it was easy for me to open this up. But we were right next to an elevator train. So any time the elevator train came by, You would hear the noises here, but apparently people didn't mind it.
You didn't have to close it each time you saw a train coming, did you?
No. I guess people just adjusted to that.
Now, Sidney never got a job in one of those fancy air-conditioned theaters uptown, but the third one he worked in was air-cooled. That's how the theater described it, on a big banner hanging under the marquee outside.
And they had one of these large horizontal circular fans up on the roof, and under it was a large body of water. So this cooled it somewhat. Not great, but it was cooler than the outside.
Did your theaters charge a little less than those frontline theaters?
Oh, yes. We charged, hold on to your hat, 10 cents up until 6 o'clock and 15 cents after that. On Broadway, you paid a quarter.
Now, it probably would be fair to say that Sidney thought of each of his three movie theater jobs as a little better than the one before. And that's because each one was a little cooler than the one before on those hottest Brooklyn summer evenings. But in the early days of air conditioning, not everybody agreed that it was such a great thing. And it was no small task for the air conditioning industry to win their skeptics over. Fortunately, they had science in their corner. Here's historian Gail Cooper again.
In 1922, research engineers published what they called the comfort chart, which was a chart of temperature and humidity levels at which most people were comfortable.
As I recall, at some point, these engineers actually wage war on the term fresh air, because to suggest that air was fresh outside by implication meant that it was not fresh inside.
A house that didn't have fresh air might be subject to tuberculosis. It was a different time, and people worried about health. They thought of the inside as sometimes being unhealthy.
Mm-hmm.
So you had open-air schools that did not heat or close the windows. They often had classes outside year-round. There were even open-air schools in Chicago, and they issued each student a fur-lined sleeping bag so they could sit in their desk all bundled up. But engineers pointed out that in the urban environment, air that comes in off the streets is not necessarily healthy or clean.
Right.
They thought, in fact, their machinery could restore to air its natural purity and that it was better than fresh air.
Now, I recall my first air conditioner in Miami being this window unit that made a lot of noise. And in fact, there was only one in our house. It was my parents' bedroom. And on really hot nights, we'd be allowed to stay up a little later and just watch TV. And in fact, it seems like air conditioning and TV went hand in hand after World War II.
They certainly did.
And it hummed along and it dripped. But we also turned it off. We would open the windows to sleep at night. Until I read your book, I didn't really even know why that was, but obviously my parents were of a generation who thought fresh air was better. Reading your book, I realized it was a kind of a battle between the engineers who wanted central air because it was efficient, and of course they could control all the elements, and those kind of old-fashioned people who wanted to be able to exercise individual control over their window units. So who won? I mean, I look around, I go back to Miami, and everybody has central air conditioning. Everything is cooled. I mean, have the window openers been defeated once and for all, or are they coming back with the skyrocketing cost of energy?
Well, in the post-war period, we built air conditioning into our office buildings and into our homes. We have an architecture that is dependent upon mechanical ventilation. And you can't turn off the air conditioning system because the windows don't open. And all those big glass walls just absorb the heat. So it's built right in. And in that sense, it's probably here to stay.
Gail Cooper is a history professor at Lehigh University. She's the author of Air Conditioning America, Engineers and the Controlled Environment. Thank you very much for joining us today, Gail.
Thank you, Brian, for having me.
Okay, Ed, crank up the air conditioning because you're going to be on the hot seat.
I'm ready.
It seems to me that one of the most dramatic changes in the South, I'd say the most dramatic change is the Civil Rights Revolution, and I'd say that for the whole country, actually.
Mm-hmm.
But second, air conditioning made for a huge change because of the demographic impact it had on the South, not just the South, but Sunbelt areas in general.
You know, I think that's a really good point, Brian. And it's interesting how those two events of the civil rights movement and air conditioning sort of coincided to trigger the emergence of the American South as a okay international corporate headquarters.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
You know, and that civil rights removed the moral stigma that would have kept companies away, and air conditioning removed the humidity stigma that kept people away.
Yeah,
and suddenly, what had been sort of the bane of the South becomes its great bounty. So we mm-hmm. go from being, golly, who'd want to live down there, to the Sun Belt. Come down where it will always be the perfect temperature.
So the climate down there changed in more ways than one, right, Ed?
Yeah, the political climate, the racial climate, and the climate.
Right. You know, I thought it was really interesting about this fresh air business. You know, I think what occurred to me is the fresh air fund that the New York Times runs
yes.
every year of
That's
sending
a great point.
Kids yeah. from the city out to the country. It's this idea of a wholesome place, and it's, of course, partly associated with the climate, but it's more kind of a broad environmental thing. And get them out into the fresh air.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, when I think of fresh air, Peter, I think all the way back to ye olden times of your period when
right.
people talked about miasma and the quality.
Yeah.
Was that the air or just
you know
the general atmosphere?
The late modern equivalent of colonial miasma is a sick building.
Yes.
A sick building is a climate-controlled
yeah.
building, and there is this problem is that then it becomes a closed system with pathogens.
Oh, and remember Legionnaire's disease. How scary was that?
Yeah.
That we're actually inventing these things in the ducts that are going to really be deadly. It's like, yikes, if we can't even condition the air, then what can we control?
I'll tell you what we can control. We can control the end of this show.
No.
And we've reached it. But remember, the conversation continues online. Drop in at our website and let us know what you think of all of this. The address is backstoryradio.org. You can sign up for a podcast there, subscribe to our newsletter, and join us on Facebook and, yes, now Twitter.
Again, it's all at backstoryradio.org. Don't be a stranger.
Backstory is produced by Tony Field with Catherine Moore and Eric Verkirky. We had help from Lydia Wilson. Special thanks today to Matthew Gibson, a.k.a. the voice of the Ice King.
Jamal Milner mastered the show. Gabby Alter wrote our theme. Backstory's executive producer is Andrew Windham.
Major production support for Backstory is provided by the Colonial Williamsburg Foundation, committed to the idea that the future may learn from the past. Major support also comes from the University of Richmond, offering a combination of the liberal arts with law, business, leadership studies, and continuing education. More information is available at richmond.edu.
Support also comes from the David A. Harrison Fund for the President's Initiatives at the University of Virginia, UVA's Miller Center of Public Affairs, the National Endowment for the Humanities, Carrie Brown Epstein and the W.L. Lyons Brown Jr. Charitable Foundation, James Madison's Montpelier, Marcus and Carol Weinstein, Trish and David Crow, J.M. Weinberg, and an anonymous donor.
Peter Onuf is the Thomas Jefferson Memorial Foundation Professor of History at the University of Virginia. Brian Ballow is a professor of history at the University of Virginia and UVA's Miller Center of Public Affairs. Ed Ayers is president and professor of history at the University of Richmond. Backstory was created by Andrew Windham for VFH Radio at the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities.